What's the best way to treat insomnia?
Identifying the most common emergency surgeries.
What's the relationship between depression and dementia?
And complications associated with the internal cardio defibrillator.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 6th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, why don't we turn right to Annals of Internal Medicine? Gosh, this ongoing issue of insomnia, lots and lots of medicines out there to treat it, warning signs if you do that, all sorts of other strategies. Looks like we might finally have the first thing to try if people have that condition.
Well, this is a pretty extensive look at how to treat a pretty common condition. It's estimated that 1 in 10 people have chronic insomnia. This is people that have sleep disorders that interrupt their daytime activities or work and have gone on for at least 3 months. So we're not talking about the episodic, oh, I can't get to sleep. But we're talking about people that have chronic issues. About 1 in 10 people suffer from this. And as you know, it's more common in the elderly. So the issue is, what's the best treatment? This task force looked at both cognitive or behavioral treatments and drug treatments. They looked at all the data that were available. What the investigators found is that, first of all, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia ends up being most effective and least associated with harm. And as a result, that is their primary recommendation. This ought to be the first treatment. Conversely, with regard to the medications, and there are several different classes of medications, they found that initially they're only recommended for short-term treatment, no more than 4 to 6 weeks. Secondly, as they were not terribly effective, the sleep may have gotten a little bit better, but the people still fell within the definition of having sleep disorders. Furthermore, they're associated with more problems such as daytime somnolence, cognitive dysfunction, fractures, and accidents as well. So the recommendations are, first of all, to pursue cognitive behavioral therapy and only reserve the pharmacologic agents after healthcare providers had an extensive discussion with the patient, talking about the risk-benefit ratio, and then only for a short period of time.
Let's talk about how we implement this particular strategy, because of course, CBT, it takes a little bit of time to acquire that skill set, and during that time, people are still going to be having the problem with insomnia.
And that's one of the major issues. Only about 1 in 9 people that present to their primary care physician with this issue actually get cognitive behavioral therapy. A lot of that's due to reimbursement issues. It can't be reimbursed if it's provided in the setting of the physician's visit. It has to be provided outside. And as you and I know, there aren't as many people trained in it. Now, there are alternative ways to deliver it. It may be most effective done face-to-face, but it's also been shown to be effective when provided in terms of groups and electronically as well. What we need to do is we need to press the payers to reimburse the provision of cognitive behavioral therapy so it's available to more patients.
And also, I guess, counsel patients when they have this particular complaint and they're willing to try CBT.
And when you say try, it's been effective in either relieving or improving the symptoms in about 70 to 80% of individuals. So it's very effective.
Excellent. Since we're in annals then, why don't we talk about something that's right in your roundhouse? Wow, what about these implantable cardio defibrillators? Yikes, here's a mouthful. What happens with those things?
These are devices that can be life-saving in individuals that have had sudden cardiac death or in people that are at risk for it. When we put them in, as many as 2/3 or 3/4 of individuals never use it. We have little data about the long-term complications. So as a result of being able to look at a national database and also Medicare billing, these investigators studied almost 115,000 Medicare patients who underwent their first time AICD, automatic internal cardio defibrillator implantation. What they discovered is that for every 100 patients followed for a year, 6.1 of the patients had a device-related complication. And about 1/3 of those required a reoperation. It was more common if the device was more complex, that is, had more leads to different chambers of the heart, more common in younger than older individuals, and more common in females and in individuals who are Black. I think this arms us with information that we need to inform the patient that although this device may be life-saving, there are potential complications associated with it.
Okay. There's, of course, a lot of other issues related to these devices, too. Not, of course, addressed in this particular article, but I would suggest also needs to be talked about with patients.
And what are those issues, Elizabeth?
Well, I guess something that's come across the transom for me has been this idea of, well, what happens when that device A goes off? I think people are often not advised ahead of time of what that's going to be like.
You're right. And this particular study didn't address that. It didn't address what are called inappropriate shocks, which occur in up to 15% of individuals. So again, these devices can be life-saving in some individuals. And in other individuals, the indications are somewhat iffy. For those individuals, they need to be informed of these complications. These complications are increased with the more complex devices. Sometimes we give people the Cadillac when the Volkswagen would be perfectly fine.
Ongoing. We're going to hear more about this, undoubtedly. Let's turn from here, Rick, to the Lancet. Something that everyone, I think, is trying to get their arms around. Can we determine whether someone is going to develop dementia? And in this case, what's the relationship between depression and dementia?
This issue of late life depressive symptoms and how they relate to the development of dementia has been studied extensively, but it's been studied in a way that is probably not very relevant. And that is people at a single point have assessed whether the older patients are depressed or not, and then later on do they develop dementia. But that neglects the fact that there's obviously a course of depression. Some have a chronic increasing or decreasing course of depression. The real question is, do those particular courses actually predict the development of dementia? The thought being that what caused depression is a prodrome to dementia. This particular study was actually a population-based study in Rotterdam of individuals 55 years or older. They had continuous assessment of depression so they could follow the course. These were all individuals who were free of dementia when they entered, and they could ascertain whether they developed dementia later on in the study. The follow-up was for 11 years. They assessed 325 individuals. And what they discovered, no surprise, is there are different trajectories. And of that group, 434 developed dementia. Only the trajectory of increasing symptoms was the one associated with a higher risk of dementia. If the depressive symptoms got worse over the follow-up, they had a 47% increased risk of developing dementia.
I think the best interpretation for us right now relative to this study is that if someone has increasing depressive symptoms as they age, that may indicate that dementia is developing. But other than that, I'm not sure exactly what the practical import of this would be.
And I think that's a very important message. That is, at a single point in time, the presence of depression does not predict future development of dementia. And I think that's absolutely right. And that's what I think is the main value of this particular study.
It also points, at least to me, to the search for how can we tell who is going to develop dementia. And we really aren't too good at that at the moment.
No. You say, well, what's the overlap? It may be that it's a vascular issue that predisposes to depression and then dementia, atrophy of parts of the brain, or even could be inflammation.
And I'll just share that I was recently at a seminar relative to the development of Alzheimer's disease, where the statement was made that much like cancer, many people believe that Alzheimer's is merely the clinical manifestation, the tip of the iceberg, what we recognize, but that in fact, the etiology is way broader than that. So for any one individual, it could be a multitude of things that will result in that clinical manifestation.
Thanks for bringing that out.
Surely. Finally then, let's turn to JAMA surgery. Wow, this is a really interesting study in my mind. What are the most common emergency surgical procedures? And gosh, what do those things cost us? How can we figure out how to handle that?
Well, when you initially identified this study, and I guess our listeners should know that we both have input into which studies we're going to talk about, I was actually a little surprised. I thought it was a yawner. And then the more I read about it, the more I realized how little we knew. This study identified 421,000 different encounters associated with emergency general surgeries. This represents about 2.1 million people annually over this four-year study period. What they discovered was that there were seven different procedures that accounted for 80% of the procedures called emergencies, 80% of the deaths, about 80% of the complications, and about 80% of the cost nationwide. So this will allow us to hone in.
And of course, we must identify, even though this is somewhat of a lengthy list, let's identify which ones those are.
All righty, you ready?
I'm ready.
Partial colectomy, small bowel resection, gallbladder surgery, operative management of peptic ulcer disease. Next is if people have adhesions in their abdomen and they have to take those down. And the last two are appendectomy and a laparotomy, an operation to look inside the belly for a particular problem. These seven procedures account for most of the admissions, deaths, complications, and inpatient costs.
We could obviously speculate on some of these regarding, hey, how could we make sure that they don't have to be done on an emergent basis? And also, there's emerging evidence, at least with regard to appendectomy, that it could be treated medically instead of surgically. But I'm guessing that what we really need to do is turn back to our surgical colleagues and say, okay, you guys, now you know this. How could you approach this in a way that made some sense?
And instead of grouping all of these as emergency surgeries, it's look at each of the individual surgeries, look at the outcomes across the United States, and identify those that have the best outcomes and see what are they doing different than those that have the worst outcomes. So your point's well taken. Identifying these will help us to identify best practices and how to move from more emergent surgeries to more elective surgeries, I hope.
I guess I would also add to that the fact that a lot of these emergent procedures take place at times when the OR and the units and all that are not fully staffed or not staffed with the people with the most experience.
You're right. The outcome depends not only on the surgeon, but the surgical team, both in the operation and postoperatively. That is caring for the patient as well.
Okay.
Good point.
On that note, I'm going to talk about depression and dementia this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.